Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you listen to Radiolab, you're probably familiar with Latif Nasser's work. He's the show's director of research, and he's produced stories on a wide range of subjects, including medieval robots and a polar bear who liked to have sex with grizzly bears. Latif also hosted the 6-episode podcast series called The Other Latif. It's about a guy with the same name as Latif, who is a detainee at Guantanamo Bay. Now Latif, the Radiolab one, is the host of a Netflix docuseries called Connected.
It's a science series about the ways, all the various ways, we are connected to one another and to our world. And I basically go around the world and sniff out these sort of stories of subtle, surprising science that, that hopefully will make viewers see the world in a whole new way.
Mm-hmm, definitely, yeah. It seems pretty involved. Each episode has a theme like surveillance or poop, and you tell several mini stories in each episode, and you travel, as you mentioned, to practically every corner of the planet to do it. What are the biggest challenges you face in creating each episode?
I actually think the biggest challenges were not mine. I had fun. Like, to me, I was in a candy store. Like, I was like, I'm going to imagine a story in this place. Like, what if we went into a mine in Uruguay or whatever? I just would imagine things. The biggest challenge, I think, was the all the producers and the logistical schedulers who are like trying to do this 6-dimensional schedule with all these production teams and camera equipment and, if we did a red eye and then another red eye right after that, like, would this work? I think in a way that was a serious feat. And for me, like, I'm so used to, just as a radio reporter, like, you just put a mic in a bag and you just go. And TV is not like that.
Yeah, the first episode is about surveillance, and your mind is blown on a very regular basis by something that you learn. What was the most mind-blowing thing you learned in the surveillance episode?
Oh, in the surveillance episode, I think the most mind-blowing thing I learned was when I talked to this woman in Paris named Judith, who's a reporter, but also she was an active Tinder user, and she managed to get from Tinder basically the raw data that they had about her. And I was sitting with her at a cafe table, and she just plunked it on the table.
Oh my God.
Wait, that's not it.
Oh my God, there's more.
Yeah, can you believe it?
This is just about you.
Just about me and my crappy
Your
dating life.
Your love life.
Yeah.
And for me, the kind of feeling of that, like, because what was in that stack of data that they had about her was not just her Tinder swipes and the messages she was sending to, you know, potential partners, like, which is creepy enough in a way. It was also all these other things. It was things she had done on other apps. So, like, that, just that feeling that it's like, and this is what blew my mind, all the apps on your phone, they're talking to each other about you behind your back. And that, to me, that I was like, huh, I did not realize that.
Now, having seen this, what was or what is the cost to you?
It's like my most intimate secrets. Yeah, and for me, it has a huge value. Yeah.
It just made me sort of, right after that interview, I remember like looking down at my phone and looking at all the tiles of the apps and being like, who is saying what about me to whom here?
Very Orwellian. Jeez, it was, yeah. Really kind of creepy and frightening, yeah. You're a producer and director of research for Radiolab. You've done stories on snowflake photography and medieval robots, among other things. Was it a difficult adjustment to shift your storytelling from audio to video?
Yes and no. I mean, no in the sense that, like, I have a kind of obsessive personality. I get excited about a lot of things, and then I get excited hard. And that basically is my only professional superpower, I think. Enthusiasm, you know? That said, there are so many things I never even considered. Like, if you watch TV and you're seeing an episode of a hosted show and the host is just sort of walking alone through the desert, like, I don't know, in my head, I just thought they were alone. They are not alone. there's an entire camera crew behind them, all the support staff, so many people, so many logistical schedulers, so many, you know, location releases, so many this, that, the other thing. There's so much more to it, to making TV, actually. And in a way, obviously, there are pluses to that, too. Like, the graphics folks that I worked with, they're these sort of Terry Gilliam-esque, just wild minds. I would give them crazier and crazier assignments or ideas, and they would come back with these like beautiful, bespoke, bizarro creations. So that was a thing where I was like, oh, this is just a whole new level of fun. Like, I can't believe that I could take my storytelling and pop it out an extra dimension.
Yeah, yeah. How are you handling being the face of something instead of just the disembodied voice?
I think it's been weird for some regular Radiolab listeners to see my body, my persona. But I think, I mean, there were so many moments early on in the early shoots where I would later watch the footage and like I'd be like, why are you nodding so much? Why is your hand like all over up in your face? Like, what are you doing? The other thing is, and I mean, you know this because literally we're doing it right now. We're recording ourselves on separate tracks. So if you reacted to something I said, like you could cut it out later. I happen to be a very vocal interviewer, so I'll be like, wow, oh man, oh amazing. Like, and I just do that naturally, and then I like cut it all out because I'm like embarrassed of my zealousness. But you can't do that in TV because you're right in the same place with the person, you know, talking to them in real time.
Yeah.
So yeah, there were just all these things that I had to learn the hard way. What it meant to actually have a body in a real space and on a screen.
Yeah, but you shouldn't be embarrassed by your zealousness because I thought the nodding worked really well. And as you mentioned, your superpower is your enthusiasm, although I think you have more superpowers than that. So, but I mean, that's what, yeah. So, yeah. A couple of years ago, you wrote a guide to finding stories called The World's Biggest Scavenger Hunt. Can you share a couple of your favorite tips with us? Not that we need your help or anything. I mean, we are talking to you, aren't we? So we are obviously doing something right, but.
Well, I think to me, that's pretty much my job, right? It's my job is to find stories. And it's the part of my job I love the most. And so often that's when I tell a story, that's the first question everyone has. And so that's why I wrote that sort of manifesto. And the manifesto is kind of, I think there are a lot of like little handy tips and tricks in there. But the big point of it, I think, that I really wanted to get across was there's this feeling that people have where it's like, oh my God, how do I find stories? I'm so stuck. I don't even know how to do that. And to me, it requires a reframe. So like, you're like, okay, just imagine there are however many, 7 billion people on planet Earth. If you imagine that even a fraction of them, 10%, even 1% of them have interesting stories worth telling, you're into a number here that is still, it's, you know, that all the news outlets in all the world could not possibly cover. And that those are just alive people. You also have dead people, and you also have animals and plants and microbes and stars and companies and planets. There are just a million things. And to me, it's like this feeling that there is around us, there is an infinity of stories. And so the fun for my job, it's a scavenger hunt. It's like, I went raspberry picking the other day, and it's like, you're looking for just the right raspberry, you know? And it's to me, that's there's just such a thrill in that. And I love the hunt. And I think if you think about it that way, as opposed to, oh God, I'm on deadline, I need a thing by tomorrow, and I'm like, that makes it sort of stressful and homeworky. But the idea of like, I'm going raspberry picking, like this is going to be fun. Yeah. To me, if you flip it like that, all of a sudden stories just sort of bubble up around you.
Yeah, yeah. You recently released a limited investigative podcast called The Other Latif. Who is The Other Latif, and how did you discover him?
Yeah, this was one of the eeriest moments of my life. I was on Twitter, I was procrastinating, and then I saw someone tweeting about me to the president of the United States. And I was like, what does this even mean? And it turned out they weren't tweeting about me. They were tweeting about this other guy who had my same name, who was a detainee at Guantanamo Bay, detainee 244. And so I just started trying to find as much as I could about this guy. What I found was that the government basically alleged that he was a top aide to Osama bin Laden. He was Al-Qaeda's top explosives expert. Just they painted a picture of this guy as very, very, very scary. And then I talked to his lawyer, who basically said, no, he was never in Al-Qaeda, didn't have a relationship with Osama bin Laden. This guy was just wrong place, wrong time, and he's been in Guantanamo for almost 20 years without charges even. And to boot, in 2016, the Obama administration and a number of like career civil servants in the Obama administration unanimously decided to let this guy go home to Morocco. But for mysterious reasons that I tried to uncover in the podcast, he's still there. He's still in Guantanamo, you know, 4 years later. So to me, I found all this out. My head was totally spinning. It felt very eerie that this could be happening to a guy with my name. And so I basically spent 3 years investigating who this guy is, whether he did what he said, what the U.S. government said he did, what the evidence for that was, what kind of I thought actually should happen to this guy. It's kind of like this guy never got a trial, and then the only trial he ever got was like in a podcast.
Mm-hmm. You met his family, right?
I did.
How were you received by them?
Oh man, it was overwhelming. I walked into his home in Casablanca. This was the home that this man, the guy in Guantanamo, who I'm not allowed to meet or talk to, he was born and raised in this home. And I walk in, he has a bunch of brothers and sisters. His parents are dead. His dad died while he was in Guantanamo. His sister, when she saw me, she just looked at me and she just gasped. And then she kind of ran up to me and she said, basically through an interpreter, like, look, I knew you were coming. I knew you had his name, but what I didn't realize is you had his height, you had his build, you look like him, and you're the age that he was when I last saw him. And I just froze. Like, there have been so few moments like this in my career as a journalist where, like, I just froze. I did not know what to do. And then she just grabbed my arm.
You are like my brother. You are my brother. My brother who was still to come. She said that you are like her brother who are waiting for to come. I see the innocence that's in his face, in his features that are similar to their brother. You are a new member of the family.
You are a brother of them. They have to know everything about
you. They asked to see photos of my son back home.
Is this a good one?
Yeah.
Okay, here. Oh. This is my son.
Halili.
How beautiful.
Just then.
Hi. He's this guy's age.
One of the really little kids came into the room and hugged my leg. That story was like unlike any other story, and that moment was unlike any other moment in my career.
Yeah, wow, that's an amazing story. Well, one of our favorite episodes of Radiolab is one that you did. It focuses on the NHL All-Star Game and a player named John Scott. What's the story there?
Oh, this is just, I love this story so much. It's the story of a practical joke, a kind of a mean practical joke. Basically, what happened is that the NHL in 2016 opened up who should go to the All-Star Game to fan voting. And fans, basically, there was this sort of mischievous band of podcasters who came up with this idea that what if we voted the worst guy in the league to the All-Star Game? And basically, that joke took off. Went viral. Like, this guy got more votes than, you know, the next few people combined. He soared to the top of the voting so much so that they like took the numbers off the website because it sort of made them look bad.
Wow.
And so this guy, he's a big, burly kind of a guy. He's what's called an enforcer. He's like I don't need to tell anybody from Wisconsin about hockey, I guess. But he's not an all-star, and he was the first one to admit it. But basically what ended up happening was this guy goes, Cinderella-like, goes to the all-star game and ends up playing the best game of his life. John's just like a few feet from goal, and the goalie's actually out of position.
I had a wide-open net, and I shot it, and I missed the net.
Like a wide-open net.
But the goalie was luckily sliding back into position.
And so the puck hit the goalie, bounced off the goalie, and
Scott!
Into the back of the net.
Scores! Johnny Scott!
There you go.
It was cool. Everybody went nuts. That was the neat thing. The crowd, I didn't know how they were going to react. Usually they boo me because everybody booed me, and they were all for it.
And John Scott will get a standing ovation.
Up until that point in his career, he had scored, if I'm remembering right, I think it was 5 goals in his whole career. And then he scored 2 goals in this one game, one MVP of the NHL All-Star Game, which is like, you know, the best hockey players in the world among them. And he just excelled. And it was this story of, well, I think we called it a goof on a goon. Yeah, that then sort of flipped back around to have a totally Disney ending.
Yeah. Wow, yeah, that's amazing. And then when he went back, when John went back to the like regular games, was he able to maintain the magic that he displayed in the All-Star game?
Oh, he pretty much retired right after that. He's like,
okay,
I'm leaving.
Yeah,
I'm leaving on a high
note. Okay, exactly.
I'm leaving on a high note.
Yeah.
I can't top that.
Yeah. Well, so what is next for the increasingly influential Latif Nasser brand? Endorsement deals, political office, maybe your own line of stylish dog shirts?
Yes, I'm, you know, signing all kinds of shoe endorsements and sadly the world of public radio and documentary film is not as lucrative and shiny as that. But I don't know. I feel like I'm in a groove, and I feel like this weird superpower that I seem to have, which is that I just get obsessed about things. I get enthusiastic about things. Like I'm just going to keep doing that because I think that there's so much that's scary and wrong and horrible and sad that's going on all around us. But there's also so much beautiful and poetic and worth, you know, shouting from the rooftops. And like, that's my job. And I'm okay with that being my job. And I think that hopefully it'll make a difference, and it'll make some meaning out of this crazy world that we live in. And that's what I want to keep doing.
Yeah. Latif Nasser, thank you very much.
I'm so flattered. Thanks for having me. It was really a pleasure.
Latif Nasser is the host of the Netflix docuseries Connected, The Hidden Science of Everything. You can find out more about Latif and Connected at wpr.org/beta.
If you've got like the relative or the friends who have the political view that makes you crazy, there's a way to navigate that such that we're not enemies.
Wisconsinite Melissa Falavino talks about her critically acclaimed essay collection, Tomboyland. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.